This is greatest hit number 5, and it's called Creating Institutional Change for Underrepresented Groups. Now, this is from season 4, episode 7. Just before we get into the episode, I wanted to ask you, are you where you want to be in your career? Well, if you know that you were made for more, then it's time to start getting clear on who you've become throughout your career and rethink where you want to go. Now, I've developed a free career clarity guide for you so that you can assess your skills, strengths, values, and mission to help you move towards the career that you want. You can download your guide today at varaicoach.com. That's Varai, V-O-R-A-I coach.com. Hello and welcome to the Change and Transition podcast with me, your host, Crystal Debra-Ecole. Now, on today's episode, we will be talking to Edeline John, who is an Inclusion Advisory Board member at the Football Association. She's also a multi-award-winning diversity, inclusion, belonging and culture expert, and she's a consultant. So in this episode, we're going to get 2 for the price of one. So Edeline will speak to us about how she's been able to climb and rise to the top in the corporate world, but also she'll talk to us about ways to create institutional equality for underrepresented groups. Now, we know this is an issue, and so she's been very, very, very generous in giving us a lot more insight into what it's about, but also what institutions can do, what senior leadership can do, but also what we can do as individuals to deal with this issue. Now, I personally learned a lot from this conversation, and I do have some actionable steps that I need to take, and I'm sure that you too will learn a lot from this session. So as usual, sit back, relax, and enjoy. So hi, Edeline. Thank you very much for joining us on the podcast today.
Thank you for having me.
No worries. So just want to start with telling us all about who you are and what you do.
Sure. So my name is Edeline, as you've already said, in terms of who I am. So I am a British-born Sierra Leonean. So my family came to the UK from Sierra Leone. So very much representing West Africa, born and brought up in terms of most of my childhood and adult life in Southeast London. So again, very much up in Southeast London. But now I happen to work in the diversity and inclusion space in the city. So in terms of background, as I said, family moved here when I was relatively young, went to local state schools in and around Lewisham, had a wonderful time and a wonderful childhood doing all things good and also all things bad. Had a bit of a troubled teenage time for my parents, I would say. I wasn't the best behaved child. but able to pull it back as I was quite academic. So then ended up heading off to university at Cambridge, which opened up loads of doors and really sort of helped me hone in and harness the person that I am today.
Wow. So it sounds like, yeah, it's been very up and down. So Lewisham, I went to college there. So yeah, I know the area really well.
Yeah.
So you went to Cambridge and you said that that opened doors for you. So do you want to just tell us a bit more about what has happened since being at Cambridge, how it's opened doors to you and how your career has progressed?
Yeah, sure. So Cambridge for me was actually a really pivotal time in my life generally. So as I said, went from kind of a very, very state school and very diverse sixth form school region to Cambridge. And I'll never forget my first day at Cambridge Churchill College when I walked into the meet and greet session for freshers and pretty much was the only black face in and amongst probably 660 undergrads, I think it was at that time. And I was in my hoodie, my tracksuit and everybody else looked like they had been prepared and ready for Cambridge. And I remember turning to my mum and just being like, "Mum, I so do not fit in this environment. There just wasn't anybody who looked like me. There wasn't anybody who I felt I could immediately connect with." And that's actually where I started my diversity and inclusion journey. So I became the access and academics officer for my college at Cambridge, which was focused around going into schools with kids from low socioeconomic backgrounds, high ethnic minority populations, and telling them about Cambridge as a university and the fact that if you kind of worked hard academically, you could come to this university and here were all the opportunities at the university. So that's actually where my diversity and inclusion career sort of started. And that was very much born out of my own sort of personal experience. But what that meant for me in terms of opening doors, it really opened my mind to career paths and industries that I just would never have thought of or wouldn't have been in my frame of thinking from kind of Southeast London, Lewisham, and the people that I knew in my life sort of growing up. And that really framed, yeah, the choices I suppose I then went on to make and the opportunities I then tried to latch onto and develop from.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting, going to a university that's well known all over the world and being one of the only Black people there must have been really challenging. but it's good to see that you were trying to make a difference and to encourage others to also come along with you.
Yeah, absolutely. That was critical for me because, as I say, you know, whilst there were a few others of us across the various colleges at the university, there weren't huge volumes at my personal college, and it meant that everybody sort of knew everybody, which in some senses was great in terms of a support system, but again, in your kind of late teens where you're finding yourself, it can mean everybody's in everybody's business, and when you're trying to grow and establish who you are, that can be quite challenging as well. So, you know, if I'm really honest, but for me it wasn't just about actually opening other people's minds to the potential opportunity of Cambridge, it was about just increasing the numbers and increasing people's aspirations to realize that actually, you know, there were people who weren't from rich or middle class or wealthy backgrounds who were also there and were succeeding and were doing okay and were surviving. Because even a lot of my friends in Southeast London from my schools, not all of them went to university. And if they did, a lot of the universities were sort of more local to where home was, or they were universities that had high populations of kind of ethnic minority students. And so, yeah, Cambridge was a massive shift from that.
Yeah, I could definitely see that. So, you know, you also mentioned that you were open to so many opportunities. So yes, you did work with ethnic minorities, but I think I saw from your profile on LinkedIn that you'd worked in quite a few really large organizations. So can you just tell us a bit about how it was trying to get into those areas and how you've progressed?
Yeah, sure. So the genesis of that started in my first year of university. I was really lucky to secure what was almost an insight program with McKinsey, who are a management consultancy company. And I remember they flew four of us from the UK to Cleveland, Ohio, for an insight program with, I think it was along with 16 other students from across the globe. And so that was my first insight into management consultancy, corporate world, the city, frankly. And that was great. And I learned quite a lot through that experience and made some sort of lifelong friends who I'm still friends with today. And then in my second year of university, I did an internship in investment banking. And that was at Lehman Brothers. So again, a company that no longer exists, but was a fantastic opportunity and a real entry point for me into investment banking and the opportunities that were available there, and went on to join full time when I graduated from uni. And that really started my career within the financial services space. So started off as an investment banker, but again, because of the access and academics work I'd done at Cambridge, spent quite a lot of time going into universities and then saying to people, hey, why don't you consider investment banking as a career? There aren't huge volumes of people, again, from my background in the financial services or investment banking space. And then that sort of evolved into various career jumps I made. So I did investment banking, and then I went into insurance and did insurance broking and technician for about 18 months. But the team that had recruited me into Lehman Brothers had almost become really good friends, the graduate recruitment team. And I remember being asked to meet with one of the members of the team and just talk about some ideas as it related to diversity recruiting and some of the ideas that I had around how to reach some of the historically underrepresented populations at university. And in essence, through that conversation, it evolved into, actually, do you want to come and work within the HR and graduate recruitment team? And lead on our efforts from a diversity perspective for what was then Nomura. So at that point, Lehman had folded. The UK employees had been bought by Nomura, which was a Japanese investment bank. And I ended up leaving insurance and moving back into the investment banking space to work in the graduate recruitment team focused on UK and diversity recruiting specifically. So yeah, again, it was by virtue of being willing to take risks. Yes. Because I didn't have any HR experience, knowledge or background. Yes, I had understood and worked in investment banking in terms of the business, but I certainly was not a HR specialist at this point. But also having people who were, I suppose, in many ways willing to bet on me and willing to bet on the fact that, you know, although I didn't have all of the background and knowledge, I would hopefully be smart enough to pick things up quickly and make sensible decisions for the good of the organisation I was working for. Yeah. So that was my shift into HR in many ways. Yeah.
Yeah. And this, again, just listening to you, it's so interesting how you were able to shift between different areas. So finance, insurance, HR. And again, just listening to everything that you were saying, it seems like you're really good with people and with developing relationships and expressing what your ideas are. Would you agree?
Yeah. Yeah, I would agree with that. And I think I'm also very comfortable being uncomfortable. And I think when you make big career changes or industry changes or moves like that, you have to be okay with recognizing that actually you're probably going to be the person in the room who knows the least. And you need to be comfortable with that and be willing to ask sometimes the really stupid questions or put yourself out there to try the new idea. And I think that's why I say in many ways university was pivotal. I feel like so many times at university I felt a bit uncomfortable, or I felt like I was outside of my depth, or, you know, I was at the posh dinners and I wasn't sure what cutlery we were supposed to be using, and I was willing to ask those questions and be uncomfortable. And that for me was then something I could translate into kind of corporate life, where I didn't always feel like I had to know everything to try out a new job or to try out a new industry or a new space. And that I was quite lucky in being in that position. And I suppose in many ways, having gone through some of those challenges when I was younger meant that when I was then older and in the kind of working space of my life, I had a lot less fear.
Yeah. And I noticed that with a lot of people, so people that I even speak with, clients, it's confidence seems to be what's so challenging for people. They feel as though, okay, I want to go over here, but can I do it? Am I good enough? And from what you're saying, it's accepting that you won't know everything.
Yeah. And it's accepting that. Exactly. For me, I think I often get what I call imposter syndrome, even now, having done the work that I've done for years. Right. So I never think I'm quite good enough. But I always think, hang on, I'm not quite good enough, but that must mean everybody else also isn't good enough. So the worst that can happen is I'll be in the same position I was in before I did it. And that's okay. And I think for me, you know, I do have a strong sort of family network and a strong friend network. And I know that what I do from a career or a corporate standpoint doesn't influence how those people see me. So for me, my sense of identity, whilst my working life is a part of it, I know that I'm valued way beyond that. And that also gives me comfort and confidence, as you say, because if things all go wrong, it's okay, because mum and dad will still love me and accept me just the way I am. So that's quite a comforting place to be. Yeah. And, you know, my parents are both, you know, West African and immigrants, as I mentioned. And so they, in many ways, have what I call the immigrant work hard mentality, you know, stay in a stable job, don't be taking some of these, you know, ridiculous risks. But I'm quite lucky in the sense that I also have two parents who are very, very different. So my mum's mantra is and has always been, from a work perspective, you just need to be happy, you just need to be healthy, it doesn't matter, you know, how much a job is paying, just make sure that you're happy and healthy, and that's more important. Whereas I suppose in many ways my dad is a bit more traditional, and dad is like, ha, if they're offering you a job, just take it, you don't need to ask too many questions. And so I've always had that balance to kind of check myself as well, because I know no matter what the job is, dad's gonna say, yeah, it doesn't matter if you're working 25 hours of the 24 days, you just take it. Whereas that's not my mum. And so I'm able to somehow meet in the middle of that path and take both of those perspectives on board, but find out what my happy medium is.
Yeah. So your parents clearly have had a really big impact on you and have really helped you. But have you had any other people around you, like mentors or anyone like that, to help you, especially as you were going into an area where you were one of very few Black people? Did you have any help there?
Yeah, so when I first entered financial services in the city, I was part of, I suppose, two organisations, with SEO London and Rare Recruitment. And through both of those organisations, I had not only mentors, but actually more peers that supported me. And people who were going through similar career life transitions and figuring out where they wanted to be, what they were going to do next. And we would, and actually still do, bounce off ideas from one another or seek advice from one another. And then, you know, I have an older sister who has had a very different career to me. So she has forever been my mentor. And I don't think I make any career decision without checking in with my sister or getting her views and perspectives, because she's quite different in terms of personality. So is often able to see gaps and things that I just wouldn't see or wouldn't consider. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, she's again been critical and pivotal for me. And then I think it's fair to say at various organisations that I've worked at, I've also had one or two key people who have been pivotal in terms of giving me career advice or supporting me, or again, just being somebody who I could go to and say, I don't really understand what is being asked of me as it relates to this project, or I don't really understand why my boss is treating me this way. Can you talk me through what that might be? And they have been really helpful sometimes in helping me shape my response to that, because I think it's fair to say, particularly when I was more junior in my career, some of my reactions were a bit more emotional and were a bit more emotive. I remember feedback often used to be, oh, you know, Edlene always wears her heart on her sleeve. And I think that's a positive and I think that's important. But I absolutely recognise that sometimes that can be challenging and can be difficult. But for me, that was such an authentic part of who I was, that when people were then telling me to change it, I was saying, hang on, but that means you don't actually want me to bring my full self to work. And so as I developed and grew, I had to understand that actually I wasn't being asked to change who I was. I was just being asked to think about how I tailor and leverage that differently in different situations and circumstances. For me, it's been really critical to have those people who have provided those insights and that career guidance, whilst recognizing my desire and the importance of being authentic. They've taught me that actually being authentic can sometimes be harnessed and leveraged to your benefit in a slightly different way than might be obvious to you. So for me, that's been really critical, really important. And I've been lucky to have the opportunity to have mentors or advisors that have supported me in that way. So as I have thought about my authenticity in the workplace, and, you know, the point I mentioned around it being really important to me to be my full self at work, and that might mean showing some of my emotions or it being visible when I'm happy or unhappy, I know that one of the kind of stereotypes or discussion points that often used to come out would be about being an angry Black woman, right? And that wasn't a label that I wanted to have or needed to have, but really made me reflect on actually what does my Blackness mean within the corporate space? And that's really critical and pivotal, particularly if we think about this moment that we're in, you know, with recent events as it relates to George Floyd and the whole Black Lives Matter movement. And what does it mean to be a Black woman or a Black person within the corporate space or an organisation?
I hope that you've learned a lot from Edlene's story about how she has been able to progress through all of these different organisations. I've noticed that she's a great networker. She's really good at building relationships. She's also followed her natural interests, and she's comfortable with being uncomfortable. Now, this is great for progression, but it's also really, really key when you want to change careers, for example. So please do take heed of what she is saying. It's gold. It really is. Now, in the second half of this interview, we will be talking more about institutional bias, which we all know disadvantages unrepresented groups. So Edlene has been so generous and has given us insight into what this looks like, and also what senior leaders and us as individuals can do to combat this problem. So I urge you all to really listen to the next part of this interview and take what you can from the conversation, but also be the change, take action. We'll hear very quickly from our sponsors and then we get back to Edlene. Are you unsure whether you're in the right career? Do you feel like you're stuck with the first career choice that you made? Do you want to build the right career for you? Well, I've experienced these feelings myself, but I've made the necessary changes and now I love what I do. I'm an experienced careers consultant slash coach, and I can guide you so that you too can build the right career for you. The only question is, when would you like to start? Visit me over at varicoach.com today. That's Vorai, VORAI coach.com. See you there. And I want to really talk about that actually, because okay. It's a real issue at the moment. It's something that I'm seeing lots of organizations trying to deal with, but it's not really clear what they're trying to achieve and what equality is meant to look like. Could you just talk to us a bit about that? Because I know this is your area of expertise.
Yeah, sure, absolutely. So if I think about what I believe organizations are trying to achieve, I think it is, for some organizations, it's really at that base level of just trying to achieve Black representation. So having Black employees and Black people in the building. And I think for others, it's at the other level whereby they may have significant representation of Black people in the building, but those Black people don't necessarily feel included or part of the organizational culture. And that manifests itself in very different ways, right? So that's not just about being present. That is about, are those Black people having equal access to opportunities? Are those Black people being able to work on projects or ideas or in teams that give them the opportunity to then get promoted to some of those senior levels and the senior grades? Do those Black people have visibility with external clients, with external stakeholders, or even with senior stakeholders within the building? And on a really basic level, do those Black people have a voice within the organization? So are their views solicited? Are they listened to? Is their experience valued? And I think in lots of corporate organizations, what this recent movement has shown is actually a lot of Black people don't feel like they're included. They don't feel like they're valued, and they don't feel like they have an equal chance to progress within the organizations that they're working in. And so it really is about culture shift and really getting to the crux of hearts and minds of why people behave, think, feel and act in certain ways. But part of that is also those corporate organizations recognizing that they're not a meritocracy and they haven't been a meritocracy. And that's a difficult and awkward conversation to have, because what it in essence does, it questions other people who have progressed within the organization. And if I think particularly in my space from a diversity and inclusion standpoint, I often have conversations with, you know, senior middle class white men, to use the stereotype, who say, you know, Edlene, this organization is absolutely a meritocracy and it always has been a meritocracy. You know, I've climbed through the ranks, so it must be. And they don't even have the awareness or the basic understanding to recognize their own privilege in the fact that they have been able to climb through the ranks, often without some of the barriers that other individuals face. And those barriers are not just faced by Black people, right? Those barriers are faced by many underrepresented groups, be it mothers who maybe have to, you know, leave work at certain times to take on caring responsibilities, or individuals with disabilities who have to work in different ways than other individuals might have to, or women who maybe are viewed in certain ways for having the same opinions and the same perspectives as men do. But because they're female, people say, oh, no, you know, she's really angry, or she's really harsh, or she's really direct. And actually, when a man says it, it's not viewed in the same way or with the same lens. And so I think organizations are trying to tackle some of those systemic challenges, and are thinking about different ways in which they can recruit, retain and develop historically underrepresented talent, really for the benefit of the businesses and the organizations. Right. And I keep saying to people, yes, there is a piece about the diversity and inclusion journey, which is around your employees being happy and healthy and therefore more engaged. But frankly, a large part of it is about bottom line business and being commercial, and about being able to bring different perspectives to the table, being able to encourage innovation, and frankly, therefore being able to do better work for your clients, which ultimately means everybody's pocket is more full. So it's not just about the fluffy people piece. It's broader than that.
Yeah. You've mentioned so many things there that I can definitely recognize and understand. But there was something you said right near the beginning of that piece, where you said that people aren't getting access to opportunities. Yeah. Why is that? Why is it that somebody who, let's say, is Black is not seeing these opportunities or getting access to it? I don't really understand that.
So I think part of that is around unconscious bias and in-groups, out-groups. And I'll talk a bit about that. So in essence, the reality is for all of us as humans is we all have biases that we lean towards. We all have comfort areas. And those views are informed by a lot of life experiences that we will have had growing up as children, young adults, entering the corporate world, and frankly, the influences around us. So be that parents, friends, the media, society more broadly. So, you know, if you say certain words to people, there are certain images that will be triggered in their mind. And I don't think when people enter the corporate space, it's any different. And we all, whether we like to admit it or not, tend to very much gravitate towards people who are similar to us or like us. So people who we have something in common with. And that isn't always the obvious sort of ethnicity standpoint, right? That can be people who we have the same music taste as, or people who went to the same university or school as us, or people who grew up in the same area. And what that tends to mean in a workplace is people unconsciously create in-groups and out-groups. So it's thinking about actually who are the people who you invite to go with you to lunch when you're popping up to the canteen? Or who are the people on a Wednesday or Thursday night where you have some free time and you want to go for a drink? The first people that come to mind as it relates to hanging out outside of work. And what tends to happen is these in-groups and out-groups form, and they don't just stay within that social sphere. So what happens is when I'm then thinking about who should I staff on a project or who do I enjoy working with, because I already have an established relationship with somebody who has certain similarities to me, my obvious go-to choice becomes that person. And what that means for lots of Black people in organizations is similarly, because they will have in groups that may have other Black people in them and not necessarily the middle class white person making the decision in the organization to kind of just use, you know, broad groups and stereotypes. It means that they maybe might not be front of mind. And similarly, we also know that certain historically underrepresented groups take on what we call more administrative tasks that often are not as valued within organizations. And so to put that again into the corporate context, that can mean, you know, you go into a group meeting and it's always the woman or the Black person who is taking the minutes of the meeting or setting up the calendar invite or booking the meeting room. And whilst those are tasks that are obviously really critical and really important, they're not viewed or valued as things that really make that significant difference. And it means, frankly, they have less headspace to then be coming with the creative and the innovative ideas, because they've got to worry about, have I written all the minutes? Have I sent them out? Have I booked the meeting room, et cetera, et cetera. And so people then are almost bucketed or pushed into, oh, you know, Edlene is the person who will do the administrative tasks. We don't need to worry about that. But when it comes to actually who is going to be the person to step up and become the manager or lead this project, Edlene is then never the one that's considered, because what we know Edlene is good at is the organization and the administrative tasks. And it might be that Edlene can do both, but that's not where our automatic association goes. And so from a bias perspective, as individuals and humans, irrespective of what our ethnic background is, we almost have to take the time to recognize that we have bias, be aware of it, and then think about, right, okay, I'm about to staff a project. What are the key skills that are needed on the project? Not who's the best person for me to hang out with at the pub, or who's the person who makes me laugh the most, or who's the person that I think is, you know, going to be the right quote unquote fit for the team. It's actually what are the skills and capabilities that we need to deliver what we need to, and who has those skills or capabilities. And even if somebody doesn't have those skills or capabilities, who might be right for what I call a stretch project or a stretch assignment, whereby they have clearly other skills and capabilities, but we want to develop a certain element. So we want to give them a chance or an opportunity to really work on harnessing a specific skill. And that's where individuals can get access to opportunities that I don't believe happens as readily within the corporate space and corporate organization. And interestingly, I don't actually think that necessarily changes as you become more senior. So if I think of my own personal career, I have absolutely, even as I have moved up the kind of corporate ladder and corporate chain, I have seen how and where people will bucket me to certain ideas or certain areas of the diversity space when I have just as much knowledge in others. So to put that in a really kind of clear example, I have absolutely had managers who have said, oh, well, I think you obviously need to focus on race and ethnicity. And that, you know, that needs to be your key focus area, you know, maybe not so much on the sexual orientation side. And I sit there and I've questioned and I've said, hang on a second, but I've worked on all areas of diversity for my entire career. So why is it that your automatic assumption is that I'm going to focus on race and ethnicity and not disability or sexual orientation? Mm-hmm. And frankly, if you're a knowledgeable and experienced leader, then actually, I hope you're thinking about this from an intersectional standpoint and not just thinking about bucketing, you know, ethnicity versus gender versus disability. I hope you're thinking about how do all of those various elements of who people are interact and impact them within the corporate space. And that's up to, you know, as I say, when I've been in really senior roles, leading functions and leading teams, and that perspective has still been something that you have to explain and support others to understand.
You've made that very clear now. Now I understand. Now I understand. And it's just interesting because where I work, this has been a real issue. And, you know, I'm very blessed that I have a manager who is doing something about it. We're meeting, we're putting things in place, we're working on strategies. And that's really good. And I've not been pressured to come up with all of the answers. Because just because I'm black, it doesn't mean I know everything. No, I can only speak from lived experience. But yeah. It's just, and that's the thing, I was quite oblivious to it. I know it sounds really strange, maybe even silly, but I've never really thought that people look at my race and think she's not capable, she can't do it. I've always just thought it was based on merit.
Yeah. I think you're completely right, Crystal, because I think it's really strange. Often we don't even realize that the first thing that people see when they look at us is a black, before they realize we're a woman, they realize we're black, right? So there's been tons of studies done out there in terms of what are some of the first characteristics that we recognize about people. And actually ethnicity comes before gender. And so to your point, whilst it's not a conscious thing where people think, oh, your abilities might be limited because you are from whatever ethnic group, people clearly have certain assumptions or understanding or unconscious biases that they have built up over the course of their lives and they don't even realize, which impacts the way in which they perceive you or me in an organization. And so it's almost the willingness, as you mentioned, of your manager to have those conversations is a great first step, because it's not something that is happening across all organizations. And in some organizations, there's a tokenistic conversation about it, but it doesn't then lead to any action, or it doesn't then lead to actually, what do we need to do to change things from what they are at the moment? Or what have we not thought about? Or what can we improve? Again, I've worked in organizations or been engaged with organizations who, on the face of it, seem like they are doing a lot of positive stuff in this space. And on the face of it, seem as though they're having a positive experience for colleagues from all different backgrounds. But actually, when you get to the crux of it, or you engage with some of those colleagues, that's when you realize some of the really horrible challenges of, you know, being bullied by a manager or being excluded by a manager or having a manager guide your career. And I don't mean guide your career in terms of supporting you in terms of where you want to go. I mean, guide your career by trying to force you to work on things that you think, hang on, but this isn't where I want to develop and this isn't what I want to learn. Or telling you, exactly as I used as my example, you're going to focus on just race and ethnicity and gender and you're not going to focus on disability and sexual orientation. Well, that's not how I want to carve out my career. So who are you as my manager to tell me that this is the only space in which I can work? That's not about you helping me to be the best that I can be to deliver for you and the organization. That's about you bucketing me into where it fits on your agenda and not actually thinking about my skills, my capabilities, my knowledge, my background, or anything else. And that is problematic. And I think that does happen for a lot of black people within corporations. They don't necessarily even get to work on the types of work that they join to do, because somebody then comes, governs them, tells them, this is what you're going to do, this is how you're going to do it, and they're not able to be themselves, and they end up being unhappy, they end up leaving, and you don't get the best out of them. And what does that do in a really negative way? For some people, it then perpetuates that stereotype that they have of black people. because black people then don't stay. They then aren't retained within the organization. And then that white manager says, oh, well, this is, you know, this is why I, it's better to just employ people like me, because I get them. I understand how they work. I know how to motivate them. And there's never that point, I don't think, before now, where there's been meaningful conversations about actually what are you as a manager doing to make sure that you understand how to motivate your staff. It's always been, what are you doing as the staff member to change or adapt? It's never been, what do I need to do to be a better manager or to be a better boss or to engage on these key issues from a more senior standpoint? And I feel like this is one of the first times where that's happening on a broad scale across many organizations in a meaningful way.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the onus has been put on the person who's different, you know, rather than actually it's more of a structural issue. No, it's really interesting to hear all of this, because even as we're trying to work through a lot of the issues, new things keep coming up, and I'm learning more every single week about this entire issue. And I'm not saying that you have all the answers on how to fix it all, but what do you think that organizations could be doing more of to make it more equal?
Sure. So I really think, and this is where it's difficult for organizations, I believe that it needs to be a really holistic approach. So I say to organizations, you need to look at the entire employee life cycle through your organization and think about, where are the barriers to access for people from all various historically underrepresented groups within that? So, right, you know, if you take it back to even before people join an organization, from an attraction standpoint, where is your organization advertising its roles, its jobs, its opportunities? Is it in places that is accessible to everybody? Is it in places that everybody will be looking? Is it in places where, if you know, we talk about black people, is it places that black people frequent? I don't know. Right. So when you say to me, oh, I don't hire any black people because they don't apply for the job. Well, they probably don't apply for the job because you're not advertising them in places where they're going to be looking. So I literally say to organizations, you need to think through each of the stages of an employee life cycle. So recruitment, as I mentioned, promotion, access to opportunities, development, progression, mentoring, support. And you need to think, how does this need to be tailored, or how do we need to include black people in this journey, this discussion, and make it feel accessible? And no, let me be clear, no black person or nobody from a historically underrepresented group is asking for a hand-me-down or for a special foot-up or for a special opportunity. That's not what anybody's asking for. People are just asking to be viewed and perceived and appreciated and valued for the skills that they have and the skills that they bring to the table, and to be given access to the opportunities that are going to enable them to showcase those skills. That's all anybody's asking for. And I think organizations need to recognize that and need to appreciate and work on thinking about how they change their structure when that happens. And part of that is the structural systems and processes that are in place as it relates to promotion. So I've sat at many a promotion table or a promotion discussion where somebody will say to me, oh, do you know what though? You know what, Edlina? I just don't think Crystal's quite ready. And I'll say, okay, that's really interesting. Expand on that. Tell me what you mean about Crystal's not quite ready. And it's very, very rare that they're actually able to quantify and qualify that statement with real examples that don't actually showcase where they've been biased or where they've not enabled Crystal to have access to an opportunity or a project. And so, again, it's having somebody like me who is comfortable being uncomfortable, because those conversations are very much uncomfortable, who can say, well, tell me a bit more about that. But you said Crystal didn't really engage with that client, but actually, was she part of the introductory meeting to meet that client? Or did she then come in halfway through the project? Or was she given the full brief in the same way as everybody else? Or was it actually that you just pinged it onto her after you'd already had a meeting and a discussion and allocated out the work? And it's being able and willing challenge those systems and those processes to ensure that they are truly fair. And part of that does start with the recognition that most organizations, sadly, are not a meritocracy. And many of the people at the top of those organizations haven't all got there by virtue of just being as wonderful as they think they are, right? Many of them, it has been because they had access to a senior sponsor who was advocating for them and speaking on their behalf and championing them when they weren't in the room. or having a senior sponsor who was saying, oh, do you know what? I know that it doesn't look like Edlene has those skills, but if we give her a chance, she might be able to. And part of that is the piece that you mentioned really early on about relationships, because it is those trusted relationships that people are then able and willing to take a risk on you. And for a lot of Black people within organizations, if they don't have that connectivity or that exposure to senior management, it's then very difficult to build those relationships. And that then becomes part of a career challenge. So it really is a full employee life cycle positioning. Great. And so aside from thinking about the full employee life cycle piece, the other piece is really about organizational culture. And that is beyond processes or systems. That is actually about how do we as people and employees within this firm make each other feel? How do we include one another and how do we value one another? And that, again, isn't something I think has been in place within many organizations in any sort of substantial or meaningful way. Even if you go into lots of large organizations, you will see groups of all Indian people hanging out together, all Black people hanging out together, all white people hanging out together. I remember being in one organization who shall remain nameless and having a meeting put in with somebody who was responsible for an element of people management across a number of various teams. And they put in a meeting with me and they said, oh, you know, Edlene, I'm really concerned about this one individual in my team who was a young Asian guy because, you know, he just seems to spend his time just surrounded by other Asian people. Like every day when he goes for lunch, he goes with other Asian people. And I sat and I listened to this people manager or whatever we want to call it to keep the organization anonymous talk for about 10 minutes. And then I just asked him, let's call him John, just to keep everything anonymous. I said, John, can I ask a really interesting question? You know, when was the last time that you went for lunch with somebody who wasn't white? And the guy went silent. He had nothing to say because he recognized that the same thing that he was sitting here questioning and telling me was potentially a problem for this junior Asian individual in his team was something that he, as a white leader in the team, does all the time. And equally is only engaging with other white people, but couldn't see that problem or couldn't see the challenge there until I pointed it out to him about himself. And so for me, that's what I mean when I talk about the culture of inclusion. It's about taking time to go outside of our comfort zone and outside of our natural home with people who are like us to say, let me get to know somebody who's from a different background or who's from a different culture or who's had a different experience. And that is being proactive, and that is about taking time to do something that, let's be honest, it does take more effort to talk to people who are very different from you. But actually, from my perspective, the rewards that are reaped from that, not just on a personal level, but on an organizational level, help to create a culture of inclusion where you understand people in terms of where they're coming from, what might be influencing their approach to work, their thought process, the way they are. Like one of the things that we talk about a lot in the Black community, and I know is the same in other historically underrepresented communities, is the fact that we often feel as though we have to work 2-3 times as hard as our white counterparts to actually get the same recognition. And you know, you and I have discussed at times how that's something that in many ways is taught to us from home, where our parents are saying, ah, you know, you just got a B in that exam. No, you need to work harder to get the A, because actually you're going to have to get the A and the white person will get the C and they'll still take the white person, right? And you're constantly drilled into this process whereby you have to strive to overachieve because you know that you're never quite valued in the same way. And until we change not just the rhetoric around that, but actually the reality of that for many people, we are always going to feel as though we are on this back foot. And that is where organizations and leaders in organizations have to take that ownership and have to be made accountable for driving that change. It's not enough for this to all be on the shoulders of Black people or women or people with disabilities. It's actually about actually those in power and those who have the influencing skills, abilities, who own the pen as it relates to the budget, saying we are going to be accountable. We are going to drive change, and this is how we want you as our employees to hold us to account for doing this. And until we're at that point of change within organizations, I struggle to see how we're going to be able to move forward at pace.
No, you make a really good point. And yeah. So I think what I'm thinking about now is, so you've mentioned that it does need to come from the top, and people need to be willing to be uncomfortable and to make changes. But I guess I'm thinking, yes, there are benefits to diversity in a workforce, but I'm not 100% sure what those benefits are. And I think it'd be useful if you could just tell us what they are, so that, I don't know, if we're going for interviews, we can highlight them, or just again, so that people understand how it can make their business more successful.
Yeah, so for me, the benefits to diversity are not just about, frankly, having an organisation that is representative of the communities that you're working in or working with or indeed working for. For me, it's about having people who think in different ways that therefore are able to craft different ideas that ultimately take you to a better and more innovative solution. And for me, that then leads to a benefit for clients, which ultimately for an organization leads to more money and leads to more business and leads to innovation in a way that is going to drive forward what it is you as a business are trying to do. So for me, diversity isn't just about ticking a box or having bums on seats. And I've said, even during this George Floyd era where lots of Black Lives Matter things are happening, and I've seen CEOs and chairmen post, we're going to make sure that we have more Black people in our building. And I've had to go back to them and say, just to be clear, just having more Black people in your building isn't what's going to solve this issue. That's not the solution to this problem. It is one element of the solution. But actually, if when those Black people come in, they don't feel accepted, they don't feel included, and they don't feel supported by their managers, guess what? They're going to leave just as quickly as they came in. And so for me, it really is about using the different perspectives, different upbringing, different values, different thoughts that individuals have, bringing those together collectively, ensuring that people feel valued, and then saying, what is the greater good that we can create based off of all of these ideas? And it's about having people who will be able to challenge each other in a different way. When there are groups of people from very similar backgrounds or who went to, say, you know, similar schools or even universities, there's something called groupthink that develops. And what that in essence means is you all either tend to formulate very similar ideas, or your viewpoints are shaped by similar experiences, which means you tend to always land at the same point. Diversity enables somebody else to come in and say, are we sure that that was the best way to do that? Or are we sure that this is the best idea? And that does mean that there needs to be that freedom and that safe space and that feeling of inclusion for that person to challenge based on their different experience, their different knowledge, and their different background. And so that's why, for me, you can't really have the diversity piece without the inclusion. Otherwise, you don't get the business benefit and value of it. Otherwise, it's a bit of a waste of time, frankly, and it is just then a box-ticking exercise.
Yeah, I see that as well.
Yeah.
But I guess I just wonder now, so now I know what the benefits are. Thank you for that. Yeah. It's a lot clearer to me. And I feel as though I kind of knew it, but the way you've explained it makes it clearer to me.
Yeah.
So as people that are listening to this podcast and who want things to be better, what can we do as individuals? So we've spoken a lot about what senior people can do, but what can we do to make things better and more inclusive? Well,
I think as individuals, we all have the power of communication. Whether we are junior or senior, we all have the ability to start a dialogue in some shape or form within our organizations, right? Let's not wait for our senior leaders to say, we are hosting an open forum to talk about what we're going to do on our Black Action Plan or whatever it might be. Let us ourselves go to those senior leaders and say, I'm really keen and interested to understand what we as an organization are going to do to address this issue. And I want to be part of that change. So I want to be part of the working group, or I want to support the recruitment team, or I want to help us think about how we allocate client work to individuals, right? So let us be proactive in our approach. Let us share our lived experience in a way that enlightens people. And I say that specifically around a way that enlightens people, because one of the pushbacks I have often had from people who are not Black within organizations is, oh, Edlene, you know, one of the reasons that we don't engage with the employee network is because, you know, it's just a moaning shop. It's just a group of Black people who come together and they just moan about what's not right for them within the organization. And actually what that automatically does is it turns off people to listening to that lived experience and gaining any value from it. So I think we absolutely have a right to talk about the challenges we face, the discrimination we face, the lack of opportunities we faced, but let us think about doing it in a way that informs people. And some people have said, you know, a lot of people are disengaging from this conversation because they feel attacked. Now, for me, that's not about content. That's about how we approach what we're saying. And I think we need to be true to ourselves. We need to be authentic and we need to be honest. But again, let us not do it in a way where people are justified or feel as if they're justified by saying, it's just another black person moaning about how they're disadvantaged. Let us do it in a way that enables people to say, we recognize that there are challenges, we recognize there are issues, we want to fix those issues, but to inform the way in which you fix those issues, let me just tell you a little bit about me. Let me just tell you a little bit about my experience. And so I think as black people, we have to be willing to talk about it. We have to be willing to engage with our senior managers and leaders, but we also sometimes have to be willing to be the ones that challenge. Because we already know in many situations what it's like to be the outlier in the group or what it's like to be the one that's on the outside. And so let us recognize the value in having a voice and using that voice for the betterment of everybody else. So I often say to people, I recognize that my job is often to challenge and be the one that has the different view or the different perspective in a room. But actually, I recognize that that's not just about helping me. That's about helping all of the people who will follow in my footsteps within the organization and all the people who will come after me. So I, rightly or wrongly, feel a sense of responsibility to all the other black people who are working within a firm that I'm working with, not only to be a role model or to have perspectives or to have views, but also to make sure that actually some of the challenges that I've gone through is a little bit easier for them when they come up. And so let us also think about, I suppose, our responsibility to black people as a community, but also frankly to the world, to make it better for anybody else who's coming up within the organization. And I think that by making sure that we create a more inclusive place for everybody, we're not just supporting or helping black people, actually everybody benefits.
Yeah.
And that for me is critical for supporting organizations and making them just generally better places to be.
Yeah. Again, I agree with everything that you said. And I think that is a lovely place to end this podcast because you've given us so much insight and practical things we can do as well to influence the organisations that we work in.
Yeah. And it is about practical things. Agreed.
It really is. And no, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for sharing all of this information. If people do want to get in contact with you, though, how can they find you?
Sure. So if anybody wants to get in contact with me, I am on LinkedIn. So Edlene John is the name on LinkedIn. Feel free to reach out to me there. And that obviously automatically goes into my email inbox. So I'm pretty speedy at responses. And I am more than happy to engage with people, talk about their personal situations, but also to help and support organizations. So if you're working in an organization and they're struggling through how to approach some of these challenges, then I'm more than happy to provide that support and lens from an external consultancy standpoint and give my views and insights as well.
Okay, wonderful. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Crystal. Really appreciate it.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
I hope you enjoyed the episode. Now, don't forget to like, subscribe, and share for more inspiring content.